And welcome Dr. Sam Jones from my local vet. Hello, Sam.
Good morning.
No Digby today.
No Digby today. He's got a day off, RDO, yeah, Sunday.
Digby being Sam's little four-legged, furry, shadow, chocolate, Labrador type of shadow.
Golden.
Yeah, so he was sitting under the bench
before.
Didn't
see much of him.
I didn't see him hardly at all. But he was very cute. I remember that. Maggie has called already, 1300 222 612. Let's jump straight in. Maggie, what was your question this morning?
Oh, hi, Dr. Sam.
Good morning, Maggie.
My question is, is possum dermatitis
yes,
the same thing as Borrelia ulcer? And if not the same thing, what is the difference? Because when you Google the photos of the poor little possums, it seems to be the same thing.
So you're actually talking about a possum. So are you a wildlife carer, Maggie?
No, I'm not. But I became aware of the Borrelia ulcer because it's a type of mycobacterium that affects affects the possums. I'm just interested in that.
Did you see one around your place that was looking poorly and you're trying to figure it out, or...?
Yes, we have had a possum here that looked very unwell, and we got the RSPCA wildlife carers, who are wonderful, wonderful angels, and they came and took the little possum away, and he was too bad. He didn't survive. They said it was possum dermatitis.
And it was a condition all over his skin, was it?
Yes, it sort of eats their flesh away. Their fur goes. It's awful. It's awful. And... yeah, Borrelia ulcer is spreading at a rapid rate in Victoria, and the possums have got it down there. And I just wanted to know, is it the same thing, or if not, what is the difference between possum dermatitis and the Borrelia ulcer? I'm not sure how you pronounce it.
Do you see many possums, Sam?
We do. Yeah, we do see quite a few possums. Most of them have suffered some sort of trauma, and we definitely do see them come through with the bacterial skin infection. I didn't know. I'm not sure if it is a mycobacterium though, Maggie. Typically, when we see them, we treat them with antibiotics, it depends on the extent of their wounds as to whether or not they will survive. It's a pretty horrendous disease, though, and I had never heard of a Borrelia ulcer, to be perfectly honest. But mycobacterium generally can be quite difficult to treat. So my understanding was that it was just different types of bacteria that we see in the possum dermatitis, but it's just very sort of rapidly progressive, exudative. You know, they produce a lot of fluid, comes out of the wound, and can really compromise their well-being, and they lose a lot of weight, and we treat them with antibiotics, and if their lesions aren't too extensive, they tend to do pretty well. Who told you it was a mycobacterium?
Well, I have a mycobacteria lung disease.
Mm.
And I went to a conference recently and was flicking through the pages, and I see this page on possums in the book that we got, and started reading about it. That's when I was alerted to it. So then I got onto the internet and started looking at it, and I discovered that the Borrelia ulcer, or the Bairnsdale ulcer, is spreading through possums quite a lot down around Geelong area. There's 360-odd cases this year. It actually spreads to humans via... mosquito bites. But up here, I haven't heard anybody talking about it, but if you Google the photos of both the possums with the dermatitis or the Borrelia ulcer, it really looks to be very, very similar to me.
I think you certainly can get bacterial infections that look very similar but are caused by different pathogens. My understanding of the possum dermatitis was that it was, you'd start off with like a staph infection or something, and then typically you'd end up with a sort of like a secondary invader, which is the Pseudomonas bacteria. And that, in inverted commas, can be a flesh-eating bacteria which causes a lot of pain and destruction of the skin. Interesting that you've made that correlation there, but certainly a very devastating disease for the possums.
Is there anywhere that you could suggest, Sam, that I could go to find out more about this? To find out whether they are related, these two diseases?
Yeah, I think if you contacted any of the wildlife services, if you spoke to, say, for example, veterinarians at Australia Zoo, or the Currumbin Veterinary practices that look after the wildlife at Currumbin, they will have extensive knowledge on, they'll have the most recent up-to-date knowledge on the pathogens involved in that disease, and would be more than willing to share it with you, I'm sure.
Great. I'd be really interested to find out what the difference is between the two. So thank you very much for your time.
Thanks, Maggie. Thank you very much for that. And it's hard to know what to do with wildlife that doesn't look quite right.
Yes.
Sam, well, you know, I guess you call a wildlife person if you're, you know, a wildlife carer if you're unsure, one of the services that exist in your local area, but yeah.
You can take them to any vet. All veterinarians will have a duty of care to care for wildlife. I don't know of any veterinarians that would charge to care to look after wildlife.
It's so hard to know though when is worthwhile intervening and when something that would clear up on its own. We often speak to Dr. Daryl Jones, who's an urban ecologist, and one of his concerns is people who help, in inverted commas, young birds that have fallen out of the nest, but actually it's part of their normal process and they actually don't need human intervention at all.
It's tricky because the thing is you don't want to leave a bird that looks kind of possibly injured or unwell on the ground and say, okay, well, it's a little baby bird. Let's put it in a bucket with some holes in it and put it up in the tree so a cat can't get it. And if that bird's injured, it's going to suffer, you know. So I guess the safest thing to do is if you're unsure is to get it assessed by a veterinarian. You can always take it back there. I know that, you know, it's not the ideal situation for a bird that's completely well, but it's better than leaving a bird suffering unnecessarily.
Or I reckon call the wildlife carer first because they know. They might know this time of year. There's heaps of the birds that are out. You know, I don't know.
Well, the thing is that these young birds, fledglings, they can fall out of the tree. They're learning how to fly, but that doesn't mean that they haven't also been attacked. That's when they're vulnerable.
Isn't it a problem to have human like touch and smell all over them too? Like, couldn't that cause them to be potentially rejected by their parents?
Yeah, I don't know the answer to that question. I mean, I have heard of that. You know, growing up, they didn't teach us that at vet school, so I actually don't know this. You'd have to ask one of those wildlife people that question. But I think,
or maybe if you're listening and you know, tell us 1300 222 612. Nola in Kingaroy has a question, and you can ask your question too. Just call 1300 222 612. Dr. Sam Jones is in. He's a vet, happy to talk about veterinary related issues. Hello, Nola.
Hello. I'm just asking, I take my little dog for a walk about 5 o'clock in the afternoon, and then we stay inside this cold weather till about 8 o'clock the next morning, and he doesn't urinate in that time. Does that affect him or not? Is that any danger to his bladder?
It's no danger, Nola, but gee, that's incredible that he can hold on that long. How old is he?
He's about 10.
Okay. Well, he's doing incredibly well to hold on that long.
He's always done that.
He's always done it. Well, yeah. He must have descended from a desert creature, I suspect. but that's impressive. I mean, generally speaking, adult dogs can hold their bladder, overnight for 12 hours is considered to be a pretty reasonable period of time. 5 to 8, he's doing well for himself. So, but it won't cause any. You won't cause any issue. The only time you really get a problem when you've got retained urine is if there's some kind of physical obstruction for them preventing them from urinating. And that can be sort of like a bladder stone or something that gets stuck in the urethra. But they'll show you signs. They'll cry. They'll lick their genitals. They'll get very uncomfortable and unsettled. It'll be obvious to you something's wrong in that situation. But just holding urine is perfectly fine. No issues there.
Oh, that's great. Because, I just can't believe that he can do it, but he does plenty of wees when we take him for a walk.
He makes up for it on a walk. And does he have access to water overnight? I guess that'd be the other main thing.
Yes, he does.
Oh, that's good,
yes.
Nola. Okay, well, keep doing what you're doing.
Yep, as long as he's not finding a corner of the house that you're not aware of.
He's in my bedroom and he doesn't get off the bed.
Might be worth installing security cameras. You might see him get up in the middle of the night and go and lift the toilet lid.
Unbeknownst cats do to you. That sometimes, don't they?
They don't do it of their own volition. I think you've got to train them
into it. I know, but that's cool.
Yeah, it's so cool. I mean, I've never taken the time to train a cat to do that, but it'd be worthwhile. You'd never have to clean the kitty litter. How good would that be?
Thank you, Nola, for your question.
Thank you. Thanks for your reply. Thank you.
Pleasure, Nola.
Nola's in Kingaroy. Wherever you're listening here to 612 ABC Brisbane and ABC Queensland, you are welcome to call 1300 222 612. That's 1300 222 612. What's your question for Vet Dr. Sam Jones?
Breakfast with Craig Zonka and Loretta Ryan.
As the winter mornings bite and you're tempted to stay in bed, we'll keep you warm.
But don't snooze.
Or you'll lose.
Wake up and start your day with us. We'll keep you across everything you need to know from the city to the suburbs.
Oh, we love hearing your stories too as we take a look at the news of the day.
Yeah, think of us as your nosy neighbours. And of course, you can join in the fun.
Oh, wow. I'm speechless.
Craig Zonka and Loretta Ryan. Back tomorrow morning from 5. ABC Radio Brisbane. You're listening to ABC Radio Brisbane and Queensland.
This is Kate O'Toole.
Now we're talking.
We're talking with Dr. Sam Jones from my local vet, who stopped by just in case you happen to have a veterinary-related question. The number to call, 1300 222 612. That's 1300 222 612. What would you like to ask Dr. Sam Jones today? Good morning, Greg.
Oh, good morning. Look, I just wanted to talk about my mini schnauzer.
Yes.
He's in the last week, we've noticed he seems to be bumping into little low steps, and he goes to jump on the couch and he sort of misses it. And normally I'd throw a frisbee and he'd take off, and when it lands, it'd go up on its side and he'd grab it, you know. And now he just looks around like, and I did it yesterday. I threw the frisbee a couple of times. He just took off in the wrong direction. And then he's got no idea where it lands. And he's, yeah. So I'm just wondering if it's an eye infection or something worse. It just seems to have happened in the last week. He's about 18 months old.
Oh, okay. Oh, it's pretty young to have his vision impaired there, Greg. But certainly that's what I'm thinking. It sounds to me like it's the most likely thing with the frisbee scenario and sort of tripping up when he's going to jump up on the couch and whatnot. I think that if you had an eye infection, you would know about it because they're usually pretty dramatic. You know, we've got pus coming out of the eye. Sometimes they'll wake up in the morning, their eyelids are sort of sealed. You have to peel them apart and clean them with saline. So I don't think an infection is very likely, but I definitely think he needs an ophthalmic examination where we examine the back of his eye and examine the lens of his eye, and you know, examine the whole of his eye, and also vets can vision test as well. We do; it's a fairly sort of rudimentary test that we use, where we close one of their eyes with our palm and we sort of make a gesture towards their face as if we're going to hit them. Obviously, we don't, but we do that to try to elicit a blink reflex. And that is one way of testing whether they can see. And you can do that at home. You know, you just put one, get him to sit there, cover one of his eyes and just kind of gesture as if you're just going to tap him on the face and see if he closes his eye or backs away. And then the other thing you can do, or the other thing we do, is we get a cotton ball and we hold it above his head or just where he can see it, and we drop it and we look to see if he can follow it. Now, they should almost always follow that cotton ball if their vision is perfect, because it's, you know, this big white thing falling out of the sky as far as they're concerned.
Yeah.
So if he's not doing that, I'd be suspicious there's something going on with his vision. And for a young dog like that, I wouldn't wait on that. I'd get him in as soon as you can to get him assessed by a veterinarian. And then they might do those tests. And if they don't find anything obvious, they may even refer you to a veterinary ophthalmologist for assessment. So there are specialists that do deal with that sort of thing. But certainly that would be at the top of my list in terms of what's going on here, Greg.
Their eyes look fine, Greg. Like there's, you can't...
Yeah, they do. I mean, look, we think that if you look, it could be slightly milky, but I don't know. It just came on all of a sudden, which is the worry.
Thank you so much, Greg. What happens if they're... So in terms of this idea of a milkiness or cloudiness or like... Because eye injuries aren't necessarily obvious, are they, when you...
No, they can be very subtle. You know, it's sometimes you can have glaucoma, which is increased pressure in the eye, and that's not particularly obvious. You could have the white opacity that you're talking about there typically reflects what we call edema, which is when fluid kind of builds up inside the cornea, and typically that's associated with inflammation. You see that a lot with corneal ulcers and things like that. I'd be concerned a little bit about his retinas, you know, if he's got sort of this early onset of like retinal atrophy. I know that certain breeds can be affected. I don't know if schnauzers are. It's something I have to look up and confirm. But, yeah, I definitely think his vision is something that we need to assess there, for sure.
Thank you so much for your call, Greg, and all the best with your mini schnauzer.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. Kelly, good morning.
Morning. How are you?
I'm very well. How's your cat, though? You've got an elderly cat, and what's going on?
So I've got a 14-year-old long-haired cat that we found in Claremont, of all places, and his name is Willis. He grew up with a couple of cattle dogs, so he's innately stubborn. He's had hip dysplasia pretty much his whole life, and so was on Medicam for a long time. And part of the vet's advice was at some point this will get to his kidneys. We're now at that point, and he's been diagnosed with stage 2 kidney disease, and we love him dearly. He's our fur child. So, you know, we do the right thing and went and bought all this expensive kidney food, and he will not have a bar of it. Whether we sneak in just like a little teaspoon of it, he's like, no, I'm not having that. He's trained us very well. He will select what he wants for dinner. We give him options. But he's just really objecting hard to the kidney food. So what? I'm just kind of interested to know what plan B might be.
Yeah, there's a few things to help you here, Kelly. First of all, the kidney food, it is, I mean, I don't know if you've ever eaten it. It does taste like cardboard. It's not tasty food. And cats are hardwired to eat. They're carnivores, right? They're obligatory carnivores, so that they like high protein foods. And eating the kidney food is not a great time for them. And that's why one of the things that we say when we're having to put a cat on one of these diets is the slower that you transition them onto it, the more likely they are to eat it long term. So we used to say, you know, 2 weeks, and now we sort of say, you know, 6 weeks or even longer if you can make it a really slow transition onto that food. And you can start again. You know, I mean, it's not going to be ideal for him to be eating a high protein, go back to eating a high protein food, but at least if you do start again and you do it slower, he might take to that food. And there's also some things you can kind of add to the food to just try and improve the flavour of it. You know, you could add some a little bit of oil or something from sardines or something fishy, you know, just to try to improve and increase the palatability, so to speak.
I'm looking forward to your sardine-rich diet, Kelly, as you put the oil all over the cat food and have to reserve the sardines for yourself.
Yeah.
But
I can tell you that is not going to happen. Happy to do it for the cat. I don't know what we do with the sardines. If anyone wants those sardines, happy to donate, but no.
But that sounds really clever, that idea, because you're getting the
low protein,
the taste and the smell and everything infused through it. And yeah.
The other thing to mention also, Kelly, is that nowadays there's new products on the market that we use for pain relief for cats that don't affect the kidneys. And so, you know, I don't know whether you've had a conversation with your vet about those. One's a monthly injection, and we see good results with it. So it sounds like you have had that chat, have you?
Yeah.
Yeah.
He went from being sleeping a lot, quite unhappy, and when we started those shots, he's running up and down the hallway, and I have to say to him, stop it, your hips are still terrible. It's just you can't feel them.
It's catch 22, isn't it? Yeah.
He's just loving life now. Yeah,
oh, that's good.
Made a big difference.
Yeah, I mean, this is the challenge that we see with more so dogs than cats, but any dog really that has it, orthopedic injury, and then you provide pain relief. Well, then just run around on their legs like they haven't had it. You know, if it was a human, we'd be saying to them, "Listen, you need to be in bed for 6 weeks, whilst this bone heals or whatever." But dogs don't listen to us. So,
Kelly, I have a question for you. Willis is the name of your 14-year-old long-haired, beautiful cat. I was just wondering, is it named for Bruce Willis?
No. So Willis is very vocal. It's what you're talking about, Willis.
That was the other option that came to mind as well.
He came over the fence late one night. We were living in Claremont and working up there, and he was this little sub-adult, this little scrawny-looking thing. And we're like, dude, we've got two cattle dogs in here. They are going to eat you for breakfast. The cat slept on my husband that night, and then he ruled the roost. The dogs have since passed. And he will chase dogs up and down the fence line. He is fearless. He is sure that he is a cattle dog. It's very confusing.
Kelly, I am so glad to meet Willis over the radio this morning. Thank you so much for calling.
Thanks for your advice. Appreciate it.
Kelly, who has that question about her cat, you're welcome to call 2-1300-222-612 is the number. My name's Kate O'Toole. My guest is Dr. Sam Jones. He's sharing his veterinary knowledge with you if you have a question to ask, like Debbie in Townsville does. Your question, Debbie, relates to your border collie.
That's right, Kate. We have a 12-year-old, very healthy, long-haired border collie. I'm just concerned about one of her four legs, I'll call it. I don't know the veterinary term.
That's
but
right,
it's her elbow, Dr. Sam, where she actually goes down on it constantly. It's always a braise and it does bleed at times. There's like a soft cyst over that area, very soft and fatty. Her other foreleg is perfect. I'm just concerned. I just bathe it with saline every now and then. It's not infected. But I worry about, does that constant abrasion lead to a bigger problem down the track?
It can do, Debbie. It's a very good question. A lot of these dogs, particularly living in the warmer climate areas with long coats, will preferentially lie on hard surfaces like concrete because they're cold. And you can buy them, 100 foam beds and they'll ignore that and go out and lie on the concrete. And what we see is that the areas like the elbows where there's not a lot of tissue over the elbow, the bone of the elbow there, and there creates a pressure point on the concrete, on the hard surface, and you get sort of this abrasive effect. And then the skin in that area becomes reactive to that. It typically sort of thickens. It does feel soft and squishy. I know what you're talking about there. And we call that a decubital ulcer, or it can form an ulcer. And the way to manage that is you actually can buy these elbow pads, believe it or not. Now, the shape of a dog's elbow and foreleg is such that if you were to put a bandage on there, it would almost instantly slip off because it's kind of cone-shaped, you know. And but these elbow pads, the way they work is it protects the elbow over the outer aspect of the dog so that when they're lying on their side, the pad is in between the elbow and the ground. And then there's a strap that goes across their back, across their sort of shoulder area, and there's another pad on the other elbow. Even that one's not, even though that side's not affected, you could still put a pad on the other elbow, and then they're connected so they don't slip down. And that is actually the best thing you can do to try to prevent it from becoming a bigger problem, because they literally, it can wear all the way through to the bone. And I've had to do, we don't like doing surgery in this area because It's a highly dynamic area. The skin's constantly being pulled and twisted and there's lots of pressure there. But I have had to do surgery on a dog once that literally there was a hole all the way through the bone from the dog just lying on its elbows like that.
Great. That's great advice. You know, those pads, where would one go to purchase them? Necessarily a vet or a pet shop? I have never seen anything like it.
Yes.
Previous to now.
There's a few different options on the internet. I don't actually know the brand that I'm thinking of, but they're located in Western Australia. So if you jumped on the internet, typed in, dog elbow pad, and hygroma is maybe a word you could, H-Y-G-R-O-M-A, is that the precursor to the decubital ulcer, and that's what your dog's got by the sound of things, then you'll find these guys in WA and then they'll post it out to you.
Fantastic. You are brilliant. 5-star. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Debbie.
Thank you. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
We can't say it better than that. Thank you so much, Debbie in Townsville, for your question. Thank you so much for your calls and texts today as well. Really appreciate it. And Dr. Sam Jones, thank you so much for hanging out with us on a Sunday.
My pleasure.